Hello and welcome to 155 episode of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other failed musicians as masterpieces. I am Nick. I am the saxophonist of this musical duo, and I am joined as ever by Roger,
who used to play the cello in real life.
Well, there we go. I used to play the flute, but no longer. We are returning to the English language, hence the opening quotes, because I'm too embarrassed to do foreign language quotes. And we are also returning to the work of Billy Wilder. We have watched two of his films before, Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard, both of which we thought were ace.
Yes.
So we are back, 1959. Some Like It Hot. So this is, unlike the other Wilder's films we have talked about, this is, I think it's fair to say, it's an out-and-out comedy, isn't it? I mean, there's some dark elements to it. But compared to either of the previous two, which are film noir and dark comedy, this is just it's kind of a screwball comedy. And it is, it's set in 1929.
Well, not to start off, it isn't. And this is one of the things I love about the film, because it's not only that it starts off very serious, but it starts off very much in a style that I strongly suspect a film-going audience at the time would have been familiar with. There's a hearse with some big scary-looking guys in it going through the streets. They're pursued by a police car. They open fire with various weaponry. The police car crashes. They pull into the undertaker and unload the coffin with the bottles in it.
Yes, because this is 1929 Chicago and Prohibition is in effect for another 4 years. The faces on these gangsters are just, you don't get.
Oh, these guys are great.
Like that. We have, George Raft, who we previously talked about as the lucky old actor who turned down both Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon, and basically created Humphrey Bogart's career. But I don't know if we've actually talked about him in the flesh before,
I think it's fair to say that in terms of the positive things he did, he was very much the guy you go to for a gangster role.
Yes. He hadn't done an A-list film before, but at this point, Billy Wilder was...
Well, his breakthrough role was in Scarface back in 1932, and he was the guy who invented the nickel flip, which somebody else gets to do in this.
That explains the joke later on in the film. I knew I was missing something there, but there we are. So we start up, pretty serious. It's a Billy Wilder film. The dialogue is very snappy and quick and one. He's got a recognisable style, I would say, a bit like Joss Whedon, only less irritating, I suppose.
So meanwhile, our heroic policeman is tracking down this speakeasy in the back of the funeral parlour.
Oh, that's lovely. That's a lovely speakeasy.
One of his informers, Matchstick Charlie, sorry, is it Toothpick Charlie, gives him the
Toothpick
word,
Charlie.
This is where you go, this is the password. And he goes in and arranges for the raid to come in at a specific hour. Because obviously you've got to catch everybody.
Yeah, he goes in, sits. I mean, the dialogue, just here, like, what do you want, booze? No, we don't have booze. We got coffee. Irish coffee, malted coffee. it's really well done. Anyway, it is, in fact, an illegal speakeasy in which are working Jack Lehman. Have we had Jack Lehman in a...
I don't think so, no. But we have had Tony Curtis.
We've certainly had Tony Curtis, and very impressed we were, too, with him. I think maybe
in
we said
Sweet
it
Smell
then,
of Success,
remember.
Which is not a Billy Wilder film, but sometimes feels as if it might be.
It feels a bit darker and colder and maybe more cynical even than Billy Wilder, if you can believe. But my feeling about Tony Curtis is he's a little underrated as an actor because he's so pretty. I was not dissuaded by that watching Some Like It Hot again.
Anyway, here he's a saxophone player, and his buddy is Jerry on the double bass, played by Jack Lemmon. And I must admit, I met Jack Lemmon as a personality in the sort of 70s and 80s when he was doing the grumpy old man thing, which, let's face it, he was born to do. Yes. But it's kind of nice to see him as a relatively young man here.
Yeah, well, I grew up in slightly different. I encountered him in sort of Neil Simon comedies like The Odd Couple, usually playing against Walter Matthau. But it's the same kind of grumpy old man. He's doing the kind of neurotic younger man. Though he gets to be a bit different here, actually. In a lot of films, he's the kind of the, I want to say haemophiliac, but I mean, he's not a haemophiliac. Well, he may be. Aphrodisiac. Goodness me, it's been a long weekend and it's Friday. The person who's scared, the germaphobe. Oh my goodness.
Hypochondriac?
Thank you. The hypochondriac character, but here he is a bit of a different character.
I think if this were just those two, it would be he is more the straight man, whereas Jerry, Tony Curtis, is more the, I got this great idea, it'll be fine, don't worry.
I think I'm going to take, right from the outset, these two have got great chemistry between them. I mean, they just work well on the screen there.
Yeah, and we don't see this happening beforehand. We, the first time we see them is here in the speakeasy. But it is clear that they are buddies. I mean, they probably get on with the rest of the band, but they are buddies. They are roommates. Mm. They are also starving.
They are penniless.
This is their first good gig they've had for ages, and they don't want anything to ruin it. And oh shit, did that guy just flash a badge?
They got busted, yes.
And this is the thing that I love. It's just this small wordless moment. The first thing they do, well, the first thing Jerry does when he sees the badge is pointed out to Joe. And then the first thing they both do is put their instruments away.
Yeah, very, very calmly. You get the impression this is not the first time they've been in this situation, but they are.
But also, you know, this is the only way you have of making money. You look after
it. Yes. Yeah. And they also, it does a good job of, you know, their bond of friendship is, you know, they're not going to, there's no suggestion either of them. They don't care about anyone else in the building, but those two are going to get out okay together.
Well, probably the other musicians are going to be okay anyway, because they perhaps have more of a gig to go to in the future.
But, yes.
And these guys are, yeah, it's winter. We've just about got our overcoats and we're going to pawn those. So we've got something to eat tonight.
Well, they lose it all on the dogs, thanks to Tony Curtis.
I don't think
character.
They get as far as putting the bet on the dogs.
But they then go round in a kind of a hustle, a kind of sweet sign of success, kind of hustle to try and get work. It's not really a hustle, though, because they are just genuinely trying to get work.
All the musicians' employment agencies.
Yes, a nice little scene. It's all, I mean, the plot is covered. Compared to our last episode about Rashomon, this film is longer, but we've covered more plot in about 10 minutes than we do in about 90 minutes in Rashomon, which is not necessarily a good thing.
This isn't even what the film is about.
No, this is leading up to the kind of setup, which we get to now is that there are jobs for a saxophonist and a bassist, but it's an all-female band. It's in Florida and it's all expenses paid. But they briefly entertain the idea of dressing up, but don't. But then they happen to accidentally step into the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Not exactly, but it is clearly inspired by it, yeah.
Yes. In that we have George Raft as,
Spats Colombo.
Spats, that's a great name, isn't it? It's so cool because he wears spats. And presumably is also called Columbo. They massacre everyone. He massacres Toothpick Charlie and all his crew. Unfortunately is witnessed by our duo.
Well, first of all, this is a nicely efficient narrative thing. They had borrowed somebody's car, which is stored in that garage, and they talk to the mechanic to say, yeah, stick some fuel in, because after all, she's paying.
Yes.
And
yes.
So obviously all of them hide when the other guys come in. The mechanic makes a slight noise and comes out saying, "Very sorry, didn't see anything, sir." And he is simply shot with all the rest of them. So that makes it clear to our heroes that, we don't have any good options here.
Now this is, this compels them, because they are going to die if they don't, to,
They get away through coincidence, basically.
Yes, they get away because of a noise in the background. They escape in the melee. But they know, not only have they been seen, they've been recognised. They know they're musicians. They've got to get out of town super quick. This is basically a strong, compelling narrative to explain why two 50s guys would dress up as women and join an all-female band. And it does feel like, in this era, that is what it would take to do what they do.
Well, I mean, let's just mention in passing that this was one of the films that broke the production code, because the production code would basically say, no, cross-dressing, absolutely not. So they just didn't even bother to submit it for approval.
And the fact that it was phenomenally successful basically was one of the reasons the motion picture code was ended. So they do. They instead become Geraldine and Daphne.
Eventually.
Josephine and Daphne, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Josephine and Geraldine first, but Geraldine renames herself to Daphne by either changing it or forgetting the name. It's not clear which, possibly both.
And then we have within this all-female group, we have Marilyn Monroe, or Sugarcane.
Okay, this is the first time we've talked about Marilyn Monroe on the podcast, I think. And, yeah, really interesting. In a slightly iffy sort of way.
there is no question. I mean, we can talk about the filming and behind the scenes and everything. I think on film, when they got her to do what she was supposed to do, she is incredible. I think she is a genuine film star.
Yeah.
She just, her looks, her
movements. Also, it's interesting that, I'm looking at this as effectively a generational thing in films, because, you know, we've seen, for example, Double Indemnity. Yes, Catherine Hepburn, Barbara Stanwyck, who are your big 40s female stars as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. They are basically tough, smart women. They may not be good women, but they are tough and they are smart and they know what they want and they're going to go and get it. And that was a great success when most of the people going to films were women. But by the 50s, the audience is shifting and you get much more the dumb blonde who needs a protector. And that is the role that Marilyn could play to perfection.
She didn't want, apparently she was really not keen on playing another dumb blonde, but I'm afraid, yes, she's phenomenally good at it. I mean,
yeah, if we could call the height of her film stardom, say, the early 50s, sort of 50 to 52-ish, she does a lot of these roles, and she is hugely successful doing it. I mean, yeah, this is not Marilyn. She was not educated, but she was smart. Yeah. Sometimes in the ways that mattered. She was not smart enough to avoid the serious drug addictions. But, you know.
Oh, the terrible men.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was another thing, because... And think about Rear Window for a moment and Grace Kelly. Now, she is beautiful, she is sexy. I feel that what she says to the presumed male audience is, well, you know, you aren't classy enough, but this guy is.
Yeah, I think that's fair, yes. Yeah.
Whereas what Marilyn says is, yeah, it could be fun. Let's go for it.
That's fair because she is entirely
available without being tawdry.
Yeah, she's all about, oh, I can't trust myself. You meet these X, Y, and Z characteristics, then I'm yours, basically. Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
And
In this case, it happens to be if you're a saxophonist.
This is actually quite a late role for her, 59. And it's in most of the other films she was doing about this period, she is trying to be much more serious. And generally, one has to admit, being less successful, not necessarily because of her acting, but simply because that wasn't particularly what people wanted to see from sexy Marilyn Monroe. This is in some ways a bit of a flashback to her earlier career.
Yes.
But she does it very well.
She was already, I think it's fair to say, the most famous person in this film by this point.
Yeah, they were actually... Billy Wilder did not expect to have a big star in the female lead.
No.
He said at the time he was thinking, you know, we might get Mitzi Gaynor, who was the lead in South Pacific the previous year.
And then
Marilyn Monroe heard about the script and said, I want this part.
Yeah, and once that was the case, then they were going to have a... now, they'd worked together on The 7-Year Itch, I think it was previously. And she liked working with Billy Wilder. whether Billy Wilder liked talking about her, working with her, well, there's some quotes from Billy Wilder. One is that I think there are more books on Marilyn Monroe than there are on World War II, and there's a great similarity. But also when she often turned up late and she had to be... I've read some accounts where basically Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon had to be spot on with their takes every time because they knew the one take that Marilyn got it right would be used. So they had to use it every time. So I think she was quite wearing to work. But Billy Wilder also said, well, my Aunt Minnie would always be punctual and never hold up production, but who would pay to see my Aunt Minnie? And I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, it's reasonably well documented that she would always have her acting coach on the set, which, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but unusual. There are two different things going on with the multiple takes, I think. One is that she was quite seriously hooked on barbiturates and had trouble remembering her lines. In one case, there was a three-word line that she would get in the wrong order.
Literally every permutation except the one she had to say.
Which was, I think, something like, it's me, sugar. But also she was definitely trying to move into the production side of things. She would rewrite her lines to fit the character better and was a big enough star that she could get away with that.
She was also married to Arthur Miller at the time, who was also trying to do that thing for her and had a bit of clout to try and rewrite stuff for her. Apparently he would sometimes turn up on set. I don't think it was a happy production necessarily with Marilyn turning up.
One of the things that's really amazing about it is that it looks as if they're having fun.
That's the thing. You would not know that from watching the film. She seems like a perfectly fine actress. She does everything she has to. Well, she's
a bit of a flu's, nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Yeah. That you can, unlike when we talked last time about Rashomon, where we were, and it's the same actual thing, really. It's the, men see this stunning woman, they can't help themselves. I think in Some Like It Hot, maybe that is more cultural taste, but you can... Marilyn isn't necessarily my taste, Marilyn Monroe, but...
There is more than one man in the film, and they're not all trying to get off with her. That alone would be a good start.
Exactly, yes, yeah. But you can see why they are battling over her. Not in a I will kill you kind of way, but they start off sort of having good-natured rivalry. That fades away pretty quickly as Josephine starts to get on better with her.
Well, he is the sax player after all.
He is the sax player. He knew he was in there. And then we progress. They get to Florida.
Before that, I would just like to quote our friend John, who commented, there is considerable controversy over whether Marilyn could actually play the ukulele. She is presented as a ukulele player / singer in this. I went through the film just to be careful and check. We only see her do two chord shapes. She does change at the right moment, but this is, you know, one shot out of the entire film. And frankly, if it weren't recorded with her voice and an actual orchestra in a proper recording studio rather than on this set, I would be very surprised, because that is just what you do when it's...
That has no bother.
Maybe she played the ukulele in the sort of five strums that she gets to do, but honestly, I don't think there's any evidence of it here.
But, you know, I don't expect Hugh Laurie to be a medical doctor when he's playing house. You know, I don't think that's necessary. I will say, unlike most other actors ever, she does sing her own songs in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's bloody good at them. So the fact that she may not be able to play the ukulele, that doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah, I think it's just that a lot of people have just absolutely uncritically assumed that, well, obviously she is, whereas nobody is saying that Tony Curtis is playing the sax. So
no.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Fair enough. They get to the hotel, and pretty quickly we have Daphne swooped upon by a millionaire, Daphne/Jerry, swooped upon by a millionaire, played by the wonderfully expressive Joe E. Brown as Osgood Fielding III.
His role is frankly a sex pest, but he does it so well.
Well, this is part of the problem. Well, I don't say problem because it doesn't feel like a problem. There are some slightly questionable, well, it's 50s attitudes to women that we have here, but I think for 50s 60s attitudes to women, it's actually slightly slightly progressive, in the sense that when our heroes are dressed as women, they are suddenly surrounded by men who are sex pests, and they, you know, there's a bit of dialogue about this is how the other half live. They don't care, you know, if you're wearing a skirt, that's enough for them. There's some empathy with what it is like to be a woman. But even so, there are, you know, the men behave awfully, entirely motivated by, who they fancy, you know, Osgood, but Jerry and, Joe, sorry, also behave quite, well, almost, despite being under threat of death, they behave pretty childishly. But it is, I forgive it in the sense that, one, it's that sort of comedy. Two, it has a, I don't want to say progressive edge, but it has some empathy towards women. And it's a screwball comedy, really. It's a bordering on a farce, if not quite. And it works really well for that.
So, yeah, there are shenanigans. So, Joe plays another role, which is he borrows various accoutrements and sets himself up as a millionaire on the beach.
Mm.
Oh, yes, that's my yacht over there, and so on. to try to cop off with Sugar, who has specifically said that she, in the train, that she is coming to Florida to try to meet a millionaire.
He's using his insider knowledge, basically, to become the perfect match for her. When he already is the perfect match as a saxophonist, he puts on a wonderful, legendary Cary Grant accent, which he's obviously a master of accents. It's very, very good. I love it. Meanwhile, to get hold of the yacht for a night, poor old... Jerry. Jerry/Daphne has to go out with Osgood for an evening. So they spend the evening Cuban dancing. And I don't know, you could argue that Joe's behaviour on the yacht is pretty awful.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that is morally equivalent to saying, hey, babe, I'm a record producer.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But it is played with charm in that... I don't know. There's just something about him being smothered by Marilyn Monroe. This was awkward because they had actually had an affair 10 years before, I think. Or not an affair. They had been an item 10 years before, but now he was married to Janet Leigh.
Hey.
And so, I don't know, him just very stiffly, he just plays it so beautifully, and there's little twitches of his leg, when he's being smothered by Marilyn Monroe, and she comes off, and after he's recovered, he says, nothing, not a thing. It's just so beautifully played, that scene. I understand it's morally.
Well, also, awkward. I think, a thing that helps one not be as offended by it is that whole image of sexual availability that, Monroe presents.
Yes.
And, you know, even if she found out about it, she would, at worst, slap him in the face and say, I thought you were a millionaire, rather than be ruined for life or anything like that, so.
Yeah, he's manipulating her rather than attempting to rape her, I guess. But it's beautifully played, that scene. Meanwhile... Jerry has, or Jerry slash Daphne has become engaged to Osgood. I mean, it's hard to go through the details without it sounding ridiculous, but it's well played by everyone. I mean, the tango that they do, where it goes from utter misery of them tangoing together to them tangoing through till dawn, is really well done. The comic timing of everyone, I think, is impeccable in this. Mm. Whether it's the editing or not, I don't know. So further shenanigans happen, and then Spats turns back up again.
Yeah, just as you've forgotten that this was a gangster film. Here they are.
Yes. Now, this is based on an old French film, which was then remade as a German film, about musicians cross-dressing.
For no apparent reason that has survived.
No, but Billy Wilder added in the gangster subplot, presumably to make it plausible that that would be why you would cross-dress. But it works, because then they invade the third act, where just when you were enjoying it enough that you'd forgotten that it was a gangster movie, we have the gangsters turning up again.
Not only them, but lots more gangsters.
Yeah, what they call the Italian Opera Appreciation Society. I don't know, is that getting a bit racist? Probably not.
When I was running a game set in this sort of period, I had the Legitimate Ethnic Businessmen's Association.
It's well played, anyway. We have the Capone-like character who eventually slaughters Spats and his men. Again, it's pretty brutal what happens. I mean, I'm glad it's not a Tarantino film where we see the actual...
Well, also note that this guy is Little Napoleon, and Little Caesar was a film that people would know.
Because he played... Did he play... No, Little Caesar was... Never mind. Doesn't matter. You can Google it, but I know who it is.
But this guy's great.
Who's Little Bonaparte, I think he's called in this.
Yeah, yeah. But Nehemiah Persoff, whom I haven't seen before, but he has the perfect face for this part. He's
yeah, everyone here has just got the perfect, including the detective. He just looks like a world-weary detective. He's not even trying, like, he's sitting there reading the Police Times, and there's lots of little gags like that.
That's Pat O'Brien, who just played everybody and everything, pretty much.
I mean, going through the plot point by point is probably unnecessary at this point. Suffice it to say, they all end up on the yacht, heading towards Osgood's. They all end up on the rowing boat, heading towards Osgood's yacht, culminating with, I would submit, is the finest last line of any film ever. Nobody's perfect. We just played with such perfect comic
For the benefit of people who haven't seen the film, this is, we have resolved Joe and Sugar, and that they are canoodling in the back of the boat, and so now we have Osgood and Daphne. And Daphne slash Jerry is coming up with all these reasons why they can't get married. And eventually...
Which Osgood keeps replying, no, it's fine, doesn't matter, I forgive you, I don't worry.
Had worse already, you know. Yeah. But I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
That's just... Apparently that was a placeholder line while they tried to think of something better, but there is nothing better. That's why they never came up with anything.
It's just... Yeah, so I think we saw it before in Gross Point Blank where there was that placeholder ending that they never managed to work out a better one from. I think we weren't terribly impressed with that.
But we couldn't think of a better one either, but this is just... I mean, because it's not really a serious film, it does work well. I mean, as a comedy... I have said, you know, one of my definitions of a masterpiece is if I can get to the end of a film and then watch it again and still enjoy it. Well, I watched this. I told my parents I was watching this for this podcast because they're visiting for Christmas. And they said, oh, can we watch it? And I thought, yeah, I'll watch it again. So I just watched it again a few hours ago.
I feel that you might not have felt quite the same way if they'd said, can we watch Rashomon?
I would have left them to it. And I did. I enjoyed it. I mean, that makes me feel bad because maybe it's just the cultural differences and just as an art form of this is a comedy. It's just, to me, it's got the right amount of darkness. It's got really likable characters. They amazing screen chemistry. The screenplay, it's Billy Wilder. It just sings.
If you can stop seeing Marilyn the film star and see Marilyn the screen presence, she is great.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
watching her as here is a person playing a character is a difficult transition for me to make, given that you know one knows about her life and death and so on. But it really does work.
It does. I think once you give yourself over to that, I think that's in a way that's the one drag factor, is knowing so much about Marilyn Monroe and her life. But it's quite easy. I think you nailed it a little while ago when you said, do you know what? It looks like they're having a ton of fun. It may have been absolutely hellish to produce, mm-hmm. but it feels like they're having a great time. And that helps you have a great time too. It's not deep. It doesn't have a lot to say about humanity. It just does exactly what it's supposed to do. And traditionally, I think for us films, I mean, think you've said before, when you want sort of depth and thoughts about human psyche, you tend to go to books rather than films.
Mm.
What we want.
And yet, this is suggesting something really very subversive for 1950s standards.
What, that it's okay. That,
you know, Jerry / Daphne is going to go off and be happy and have a relationship with this guy.
There's an element that and it's danced around a little bit. I think the closest to the bone it gets is a guy can't marry a guy, I think, is that's the closest mm-hmm. it gets to, which I'm sure, well, I don't know whether you could have said that under the motion picture code or not. Probably you could.
I think you could say it if you were mentioning it in a disapproving way.
Yeah, I think according to the motion picture, I was going to say they'd have to end up dead or punished at the end. I think you just couldn't do it at all, could you, in the motion picture code? I mean, for me, this is 3 for 3 with Billy Wilder. It's just a great film, really.
Also, solid music. The songs that aren't Marilyn are mostly written by Adolf Deutsch, who was a prolific film composer, but most notably had done the track for the tracks for the Maltese Falcon.
The soundtrack was slightly on the nose for me, in that, you know, any time Monroe is on the screen, there's kind of a schmoozy saxophone. She's got her own signature. And in areas, I felt the soundtrack, particularly with the chasing around of the gangsters, it veered a bit close to me to a Carry On soundtrack, a Carry On film soundtrack. But it didn't take me out of it. It was only on the second viewing this afternoon that occurred to me.
Mm.
One
small film connection. The guy who pops out of the cake with the machine gun is not Arthur G. Robinson, but his son, Arthur G. Robinson Jr. Edward G. Robinson Jr.
Edward G. Very cool.
And his father was in all the gangsters films, pretty much, so...
Edward Jr. Double
not
Indemnity.
So much, but
and so as you mentioned, the flipping the coin trick that George Raft did, he meets a character who does it, he grabs the coin out of the air and says, where did you learn that old trick? Mm-hmm. I didn't get that joke, but now I do, so thank you for deepening my understanding. I mean, I'm not sure what to say about it. It's just very funny, charming story.
Yeah, nominated for 6 Oscars. It only won 1 for costume design.
I mean, I can see why it won 1 for costume design. That seems a bit harsh. What was it up against? That seems a bit rough, doesn't it? But then quite often we've had Oscar films that... we've watched a few very Oscar-winning films, many of which we did not like.
So, Billy Wilder was up for Best Director. He lost it to William Wyler for Ben-Hur.
I've never seen Ben-Hur, actually. Perhaps we should.
Jack Lemmon was up for Best Actor, and he lost that to Charlton Heston in Ben-Hur.
Again.
Let's see. Adapted Screenplay, Room at the Top won that one.
Well, that's stood the test of time. I don't think I've ever heard of Room at the Top.
Art Direction, The Diary of Anne Frank, which I don't think I actually knew had been filmed. And cinematography, black and white, was also The Diary of Anne Frank. But, yeah, this one, good costume design from Ori Kelly. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Munro actually had a standard contract clause saying she would not be in a black and white film. But when they saw how the cross-dressing makeup looked on camera, even she agreed, no, this is just a horror. It won't work. Let's go with black and white.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I was going to say 59 is quite late for a black and white film, isn't it? Mm. Okay. Well,
I am told many, if you mention this film to many people, they will just think, oh, well, obviously it's in colour.
Yeah. Okay.
It would be an easy film to remember in colour.
Yeah. It has a joy to it, and the lighting of it is in colour. I mean, for me, it's an easy masterpiece on the basis that it does exactly what it's a pinnacle of the form of, well, not quite screwball comedy, but,
to be fair, not super widely imitated. I mean,
no.
There have been films about, you know, musicians cross-dressing to go on the run. I can't remember the name of the one now, but there was a 80s or 90s one.
All I can think of is Nuns on the Run now. But
there was that one too. It's been tried a few times, but not, I think, with any great notability. But it does what, as you say, it does what it set out to do, and it does it really well. And it is simply a joy to watch even now.
Yeah, I would watch it again soon. We really must watch more Billy Wilder, though we have watched three of them already. I'm sure we'll find a bad one soon. I don't think I like Stalag 17 as much as everyone else did. Maybe, I don't know if that's Billy Wilder. I think it is. Anyway, very good stuff, Billy Wilder. Keep it up.
Mm-hmm. And all I have to say in the remaining is, with all the unrest in the world, I don't think anybody should have a yacht that sleeps more than 12.
Well, I can't end this podcast without saying he may have made some bad films, Billy Wilder, but nobody's perfect.